from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South.
The next hour involved a lot of debate around whether we could survive the leap to the creek some 40 feet below.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
Suddenly my head throbs again and the smoke cloaks my entire bedroom. My mouth is gritty and dry.
Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story, as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
It was so colorless, even Ansel Adams would have found it too great a photograph.
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
She's a cat's meow, the dog's bow wow. But she's everything that a country boy would need. Well, looky boy, she's a different bag of meat. Well, the cat's meow, the dog's bow wow. But she's everything that a country boy would need. Well, looky boy, she's staring back.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's band, the Salty Dogs? What'd y'all think? Y'all enjoy? They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? What do y'all think about our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our riders go up against the elements of wood, fire, water, and earth, and live to tell the tale. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Holly Patton wakes up to a house filled with thick black smoke. And we'll end the night with Don Strite as his wife heaves boulders in the freezing rain. But let's start the night with David Prudhomme as he teeters on the edge of a 40-foot drop in Out on a Ledge.
The sun hit the horizon just about the time my best friend asked the same question he had asked at least 10 times in the past 2 hours. How far to the trees, you reckon? I didn't reply as I looked down the 40-foot drop. It didn't matter how far it was to the trees. It was time. If we survived the fall, we still had an hour and a half hike back to Boob's house, and almost two to ours. We argued a bit more about whether we should throw the guns down first, which Boob was particularly adverse to. You two will be bad tanned if we make it back, but my dad will kill me if I bring the .22 home dented or broken. My older brother was about 10, and he thought Bear was a perfect choice for a nickname. My best friend, who for some reason had chosen to use Boob as his walkabout name, was about 2 years younger, as was I. For myself at the time, I was using James. I don't quite recall if this was borrowed from the outlaw Jesse, or if it was just because I thought it sounded smart and leader-like. Boob and I had different parents, but we were no less brothers than me and Bear. We had chosen to be brothers, and that lent an undeniable strength to the relationship. Promises of unending friendship and fidelity had been exchanged a year before in an Indian blood brother ceremony, surely gleaned from our favorite spaghetti westerns. Twice, in fact, since we renewed our commitments after a friendly dirt cloud battle had devolved into a full-blown scrap. Wrestling about on the ground, or wrestling, as Boob would have said, kicking and punching until both of us had been sufficiently bloodied. We later agreed that the first ceremony must not have taken completely, since we had used the sliced joined palms method. We updated with the sliced forearms joined by grasping each other below the elbow method, which was much more impressive, at least cinematically. We had been living in the Texas Hill Country outside Austin for about 3 years. The Hill Country is a beautiful area of rivers and creeks, bluffs and caves, canyons, and vast untamed lands. And it was all ours, or so we thought at the time. We reigned and ranged over a much larger expanse than our parents ever knew or even guessed. Our house was at the end of a paved road, and Boob's family lived on a small leased ranch that backed up to Barton Creek, about a mile down the dirt road. We met on that dirt road a few days after I moved there and had hardly spent a day apart since. A few hours before, on this day, we had been traversing a ridge line that roughly followed and formed a cliff face along a familiar stretch of the creek. I don't remember exactly what we were hunting. It was surely one of our usual prey, such as buffalo or bear. I do recall we were fully armed. Boob with his .22 and Bear and I trading off the BB gun we shared, and a great looking, but not really functional, cap gun musket. Although whoever had the musket also got a homemade tomahawk. She still had an effective projectile when needed. As we passed a large cedar tree sitting several feet back from the cliff, one of us noted an old rope tied to it. As was our way, we set about debating the purpose of this particular rope. Boob felt it was likely a remnant of a long-forgotten hanging. But Bear observed that the cedar really didn't provide any good hanging sort of limbs. He thought it was likely where a rancher tied up his bulls for castration. Although both were worthy efforts to explain the provenance of this surely notorious rope, I felt it must have a more mysterious purpose. I offered that it was likely used to climb down to a hidden cave in the cliff face, which, on further consideration, may have been used by banditos to hide out and stash their loot, and even Indians before them. My argument must have won out since we pulled the rope over to the edge and tossed it over. The frayed, knotted end hung about 10 feet above a 12-foot-long shelf. The ledge varied from about 2 to 3 feet wide, but you can tell from up top if there was a cave cut back into the bluff or not. The exact sequence of events that followed are still a topic of debate, but suffice to say that the three of us found ourselves standing on the ledge, appreciating a spectacular view, pumped full of accomplishment from climbing down the rope and dropping the last 10 feet to our goal. We could see several of our swimming holes along the course of the creek from here, as well as the spot where we usually bow fished. Finding no cave, we quickly expended the exploring possible in the restricted space, and then spent an hour or so in failed attempts to regain the rope dangling above. The next hour involved a lot of debate around whether we could survive the leap to the creek some 40 feet below, interspersed by our yells for help, both individually and hollering in chorus. Boob was confident that the 2 or 3 feet of water would cushion our fall. But Bear noted we had to leap out over about 20 feet of rocks and trees before we could get to the creek between the base of the cliff and the creek itself. Our test results from throwing rocks at the middle of the creek determined that we needed another plan. The last hour passed watching the approaching sunset and going over the same ground of prior deliberations, which was occasionally interrupted by the crack of a .22 when Boob took a shot at buzzards that drifted over to check on our status every once in a while. If anyone was likely to hit a buzzard with a .22, it was Boob. Already at 8, he was a dead-on shot. Now, neither of our dads believed in sparing the rod, or the leather belt as it was. I always wondered, though, how my lawyer dad's arm was stronger than Boob's carpenter dad. Our adventures regularly ended in a strapping, but Boob always seemed to be able to walk without a limp the next day. And he was never kept home from school to allow the bruises and welts to heal. Maybe it had something to do with my dad's Southern Bible Belt conservative upbringing that gave strength to his liberal application of the belt. My confusion to this day about the common usage of these terms as compared to their Webster definitions may have something to do with that. In the end, the guns were tossed down into the trees first. I can't honestly tell you who leapt first into the treetop some 20 feet below, other than it was not me. Blue jean jackets and pants, along with our boots of choice, Ropers for boob, Dingoes for bear, and my favorite to this day, knee-high Indian boots, all helped to deflect some of the gouges and stabs, scrapes, and bumps from the trees and the rocks below. I should note that live oak and cedar don't offer much of a leafy canopy, so I can't really recommend their use as a cushion your fall. We all emerged alive, bruised, bloodied, and limping. It was a long hike home in the dark. Though happy to be alive, we were hurting something awful and already dreading the reception that surely awaited us. We knew we could never tell the full true story to explain our condition if we ever wanted another opportunity to explore the world in the next year or two. As it turned out, Boob's dad was not home yet, so he was able to sneak the .22 back in without his mom noticing, especially after she saw all the blood and torn clothes. His tanning ended up being two-staged, with the second part coming a week or so later when his dad found the .22. Once mended enough to go back out, we had plenty of extra chores at home, as well as any work my parents could find for us to do for neighbors to help with replacing the ruined clothes. I don't think we ever went back to get that rope. The truth is, we didn't have any need for it. The experience we shared and knew the whole truth of between us surely bound us more tightly than any rope ever could.
David Perdomo has been a storyteller his whole life. The closer he stays to the truth, the less people believe him. He lives in Little Rock with his wife and son, or so he says. In our next story, Holly Patton's life goes up in flames in Out of the Ashes.
Baby, get out of bed. I think your house is on fire. Huh? Just get up. We've got to get out. My eyes are still closed as I try to focus. My boyfriend, Matt, is shaking me. It's his birthday, and we've celebrated around the new fire pit in the backyard of my home I've lived in for the last 17 years. The fire was lovely, but somehow the wind kept blowing the smoke right back into my face and had made me sick from the smell. The ensuing migraine had me crawl and climb up the 13 stairs to my attic bedroom, slip into a warm bath, and then crawl into bed naked. The Excedrin migraine and Imitrex had dulled the pain as I drifted off into my soft, warm bed. Matt shakes me again, and this time my eyes pop open. Suddenly my head throbs again, and the smoke cloaks my entire bedroom. My mouth is gritty and dry. My God, my house is on fire. I throw on my black robe and I grab my faithful iPhone. Oh my God, I scream and pray as I run barefoot down the narrow stairs, dialing 911 on step 12 with the steps. I'm crying, oh my God, my house is on fire, my house is on fire. 1319 Pine Valley, please, please hurry. Miss, calm down. Your neighbor's already called. Just leave the house immediately. I turn to see Matt hurrying down the stairs. He is dressed only in a crocheted blue baby blanket and his jacket. We've got to move the cars, I scream. He reaches into his coat pocket and magically pulls out both sets of our car keys. Matt's right behind me as I run to the front door to find my young, burly, next-door neighbor, Jason, pounding on the door. Jason, Jason, my house is on fire. I know. Come on, where's the hose? He yells. Oh my God, oh my God. I repeat as I run up the driveway and grab the hose. We stand there with gigantic flames leaping up the side of my house. As I frantically call my sons, the house is burning down. The house is burning down. And then I realize we never moved our cars. Matt's behind me and I scream, we gotta move our cars. He does, quickly, and I screech mine behind his SUV. Six fire engines roar up the street as I jump out of my car and run towards them. The sirens pierce my ears and my heart. I run barefoot on the cold December street that is now filled with a crowd of neighbors and small children and dogs. Everyone gathered in pods, trying to shake the disbelief away and praying the wind stops so their homes stay safe. Miss, you can't go back in. A fireman clothed in protective yellow garb, a hard hat, and a sad smile gently pulls me back. I struggle against him, feeling the cold, hard plastic as he says, just let us do our job. No, I have to. I have to get back in. You don't understand. All my pictures of my children are in there. All my little love letters from them when they were little tiny boys. Tears stream down my face and they splash both of us. He's holding me so close. Mama? Come on, Mama. It's okay. Just come on. Just stay with us, Mama. You can't go back in. And somehow my two sons now stand beside me, hypnotized by the flames, greedily eating up our home of the past 17 years. They clutch me tightly. They know me better than the firemen, and they hold me back forcefully. The cold water freezes my toes, my bare toes, as the heat blasts from the roof of my house. A lone policeman leads me to the ambulance and forces me into it, as if I'm a criminal. No, please, I sob. I have to go back in. Two paramedics grab me, push an oxygen mask over my face as I weep and struggle with them. I push the mask away. I'm okay, just let me go back in. Sorry, we can't do that. The mustache man looks down at me and I realize my robe is open. My nakedness is nothing compared to the raw vulnerability I feel at watching my house burn. Matt climbs into the ambulance and reaches towards me and gently pulls my robe shut as they strap a mask over his face. My migraine is back, throbbing, exacerbated by the screeching sirens. Okay, you can go now, Mustache says to me. I jump out and a lady's there, handing me running shoes. I look vacantly at her as if she's an alien. Holly, you're barefoot. Put these on. It's Mary Ellen, my cross-the-street neighbor who runs marathons. I can't. These are your good running shoes. She looks at me like I'm crazy. I am. My house is burning down, and I'm worried about her running shoes. She smiles kindly at me, and she says, they're not my best ones. Just put them on. Matt stands beside me now, silent, as he holds on to me tightly, and he tries to hold on to the blue crochet blanket around his waist. Two of my neighbors walk over to us. Come in. We've got some pants for you, Michelle says to Matt, as if dressing a naked strange man in the middle of the night was an everyday routine. He nods his gratitude. We follow them to their home. I sit on the couch, the wet running shoes squeaking with water as I sob, holding my head. The migraine, the smoke, the shock fills my body with adrenaline that leaves me shaking. My head. Michelle pushes some Advil into my hand and feels my freezing skin and then leads me back into the bathroom. Get in the shower. You're freezing to death. I comply, dropping my wet, smoky black robe on their floor. It is the second time in one night that I crave the sanctuary of the hot water to wash the smoke away, but this time the smoke has penetrated my soul. They hand me sweats, dry socks, and a cup of coffee, manna for a melting neighbor. 2 hours have gone by since Matt woke up. 2 hours is all it took to eat up a home full of our laughter, tears, and all the material things that we've accumulated as a family. Finally, the fire marshal says it's safe to walk back in the house. I don't recognize it. This can't be my house. The periwinkle bedroom walls are now goth black. My granddaughter's pack-and-play bed lies melted and distorted. Her stuffed animals burnt and unrecognizable. Dr. Seuss ashes float everywhere, along with soot, water, and burnt clothing. The fire marshal holds me up, seeing the heaviness of my grief and shock. He looks at me and says, I know it's horrible, but let me tell you something. We bring body bags out of fires like this. Attic fires are the worst. You would have been dead of smoke inhalation in 2 more minutes. He looks at the bed that is now burnt pink sheets, and withered, once white, now black, lace curtains laden with soot. God's not finished with you yet. His kind voice and his strong hand steers me back down the narrow stairs and out of the ashes. I step outside and in disbelief see the sun beginning to rise. It's a new day. The flames and smoke may have taken our home, but it did not extinguish our lives. I am homeless, but I am alive. Oh my God, I whisper one more time as I walk up the street to the car.
Holly Patton has lived in Little Rock for many years, raising her sons and now two granddaughters. She loves to write, skate, and hike, and she is a minister of a local church in Little Rock. She is happy to be alive to write this story. In our final story of the night, Don Streit leaves for a couple of hours, only to find that his wife has taken on the elements all alone in Lindy's Leisure.
It was about 40 degrees and drizzling, freezing rain when my 5 foot, 1 inch, 115 pound wife, Lindy, announced that she was going to construct a wall in our backyard with the jackhammered remnants of our patio. The fact that Lindy wanted to take on a home repair project on her own wasn't unusual. Over the years, I have learned not to try to dissuade her from taking on tough projects because she has this MacGyverish kind of attitude towards formidable tasks. I have fallen prey to her imagination and occasionally been her accomplice. However, I wasn't so eager to encourage her plan to do her own style of landscaping in the middle of the winter, in full view of the neighbors, 2 weeks after having foot surgery and wearing a cast on that foot. This time, I think her idea, probably inspired by painkillers, was outrageous, even for her. The surgeon had installed 3 screws in her left foot. Being laid up sentenced her to a temporary life of protracted rest and recovery, not the kind of thing she takes lying down. With a memory of the x-ray in my mind, I became especially queasy whenever she decided to move around without her crutches. Just thinking about stainless steel hardware invading my flesh and bones immobilizes me. But not my Lindy. Her idea of fun is similar to the hard labor imposed on the inmates at Fort Leavenworth Military Penitentiary. Lindy's announcement came when I was getting ready to go to the gym. In fact, I was ready to run out to my car that had been warming for about 5 minutes. Hey, it was cold outside. When she told me about her plan, I told her, I will help you when I get back. Do you promise to wait until I get home to start your project? Yes, you know I can barely move in the house alone right now anyway. Good. I'll accept that as your vow. This time I felt assured that her medical limitations and her doctor's cautions would deter her from doing anything strenuous without me. The yard looked so desolate, I couldn't imagine why anyone would want to spend any time outside for any length of time. The limp blades of grass, low gray clouds, and barren trees made the landscape look like an 1800s antique picture. It was so colorless, even Ansel Adams would have found it too great a photograph. On my way to the gym, I remembered a warm, sunny day last fall when Lindy refused to wait for anyone to assist her climbing up onto the roof to rake leaves and clear branches. In our neighborhood, it was the men who ventured up on the roof alone. The sight of her up there troubled some of the neighbors. She had to call on one of them to help her get down from the roof. A couple hours later, during my drive back home, I pictured Lindy patiently waiting for me to get home and she would have her fun. When I walked in the front door, I detected a musty scent in the house, a literally earthy smell. Lindy had her left foot elevated, as the surgeon had ordered, on the arm of our love seat. Her cheeks glowed a cold, wind-chafed pink. Her hazel eyes seemed to have a smile of their own. It was a look of delicious satisfaction. When I asked her how she felt, one corner of her mouth raised ever so slightly. "I'm just great now," she whispered. My suspicions were confirmed. While I was away, Lindy had broken her vow. Despite the 40-degree temperature and the chilling drizzle, she had built the wall while I was gone. I know how heavy some of those pieces were. I had already lifted the bigger ones and concluded I would need to break them up into smaller pieces before I could move them anywhere. "Honey," she quickly said, "before you say a word, it's called leverage." "Leverage and a brain." "So how did you move those 40-pounders?" I asked in awe. "I sat on my butt and rolled them over. If it landed in the right spot, great. If it didn't, I crawled my rear over to the spot where it landed and rolled it again. I did this 100 times or so to get it the way I wanted it. I slid across the dead grass using old cardboard pieces that were in the garage." "I couldn't move as fast as I wanted. I just finally gave in and slithered across the ground. Oh yeah, one more thing. I knew you'd be concerned that I might get my foot wet, so I had an ingenious way to cover my cast." "Oh really, what clever scheme did you use to do that?" "I had a black trash bag wrapped around it, and I strapped it to my ankle with duct tape. What more protection would I need?" My imagination ran wild as I pictured the reaction of the neighbors. I envisioned them coming to our door with blazing torches late at night, demanding to punish the monster that had sentenced his wife to hard labor. It would have helped my reputation a bit if my wife at least looked muscular. The neighbors had seen her petite frame in the summer, so the padded ski suit she had on only gave the faint illusion that she was meant for heavy lifting. She looked more like the Michelin Man, smile and all. In spite of my dread of what the neighbors might have thought, to be honest, I was really grateful she hadn't told me her plan to single-handedly build the wall before I left, triggering some spousal guilt. I was also very relieved that the drizzle didn't turn to snow. That might have made the whole scene look pathetic.
Don Stride is a psychotherapist and adjunct professor. He loves to write about his family because they are sources of entertaining stories and they remind him to appreciate the lighter side of life. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? What y'all think? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.